June 12th, 1994, I was a student at San Francisco State, and I was living with my then boyfriend, Joe, and I was working a part-time job at Wells Fargo Bank as a teller. I was on shift that day, and I had gone up to the break room and saw some things on the TV that looked like breaking news, like crime scene, didn't think anything of it, continued on my day. I ended up getting a ride home with my girlfriend, Amy, because I didn't have a car. I lived right near the beach. And so we were driving along kind of carefree, listening to the radio, just living a 22-year-old's life. I got to my apartment and Joe met me at the door, which was unusual. I don't know if I was trying to get in and my keys were jiggly. I have no idea, but he met me at the door. I can vividly remember that his heart was pumping so fast and I could see it through his shirt. I was confused by it because his face was all discolored and something was strange. And he said, "Hi, you need to call your dad." I thought, all right, I just walked in the door and he was following me around, like super close to me. I just remember feeling like, God, just get off of me, you know? And he said, "I need you to call your dad." And at the time, we didn't have cell phones. We had one landline in our apartment and it was in the extra bedroom. I sat on the bed and I picked up the phone to call my dad. And my dad picked up the phone and then my stepmom, Patty, got on the phone. And my dad just said to me, "Have you seen the news today?" And I said, "No, what are you talking about?" And he just said, "Do you know Nicole Brown Simpson? And I was like, I don't understand what's happening. It was just weird questions. And then he just finally blurted it out that my brother had died.
From Cast Media, this is Media Circus, a look at private tragedy in the public eye. I'm Kim Goldman. In each episode, I take high-profile crimes you might think you know and share the human stories behind the headlines. You'll hear the truth about what really happened directly from victims and their families, in their own words, on their own terms. In this first episode, I share my own personal story of loss, resilience, and purpose, and why creating this podcast and helping victims to tell their own stories is so important to me. Thank you for joining me. My brother and I are 3 years apart, raised by my father. My dad was a single parent. Back in the 70s, that was kind of an unheard of thing. My birth mom left my brother and I when I was about 3 and a half. But I think that us being abandoned by our mom and just the three of us allowed my brother and I to have and build an incredibly close relationship. He kind of took me under his wing. He became my protector. My brother and I were like two peas in a pod. We were always together and always holding hands, always arm in arm. He just was the closest thing to me outside of my dad. Without having to go into every gory detail of my childhood, it's just suffice it to say that my brother was like my soulmate. I don't know that growing up without my birth mom really had an impact on us until we got much older. I mean, there was lots of times that we were left and she didn't come pick us up. There were moments where we were supposed to see her and we didn't, but my dad did a great job of really creating this cohesive unit between the three of us. And we learned to rely on each other. We learned to rely on ourselves, but it really wasn't until a little bit later in our life that we started to realize where the deficits were of not having her. And then we just relied on each other that much more. And that was a place where my brother and I connected on an even deeper level because we were the only ones that understood our experiences. On Mother's Day every year, my brother and I would always call each other and sort of commiserate on the fact that we didn't have a mom. In fact, the year that he died was actually the last time I spoke to him on Mother's Day.
The bodies of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman were discovered about midnight Sunday on the steps.
After I got the phone call that my brother had been murdered, the rest became a blur. As I pulled my things together, absentmindedly tossing clothes into a suitcase, like 30 pairs of underwear and no shirts, there's no way I could grasp that my entire world had just flipped upside down and would be changed forever.
We were flying to the airport, we were just driving so fast, and I was just crying because I could not wrap my head around what was happening and what I was going home to and get through the airport. And I remember I needed to call my boss and I needed to call Amy to tell them that I wasn't going to be able to work the next day and that I wanted to warn them because I didn't want them to see it on the news because at some point, they had announced that it was O.J. Simpson's ex-wife.
Suddenly, my brother's murder was becoming breaking news everywhere. I took the short flight from Northern to Southern California feeling like I was suffocating in grief and confusion.
My dad had told me that he was going to send a family friend to come pick us up. I remember getting off the plane and it was a really long walkway to the exit. It was all glass and my dad was there and he was huddled with our family friend and my stepmom. And I remember just falling into my dad's arms. And then when we got in the car, the radio was on and it was the first thing I heard that they said, breaking news today in Brentwood, California, Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend were found slaughtered to death.
The body of 34-year-old Nicole Brown Simpson, ex-wife of O.J. Simpson, was found after midnight on the sidewalk outside her West Los Angeles home. Next to it, the body of an unidentified 26-year-old man. Both had apparently been stabbed.
And that was basically the first time that I kind of heard. And then somebody turned it off really quickly, and then the rest the world saw. It was late at night when we got back to our house in Agora. I honestly, in this moment, cannot remember if there were media trucks outside our house at that point, but we were getting calls pretty early on. It was probably like a day or two in that I started realizing, like, this is a big deal.
Well, obviously, we will be interviewing everyone that we think is even remotely associated with this case, and that would include any other potential witness. And I would hasten to add that everyone is a witness at this point. No one has been arrested. No one has been charged.
The media started to pick up the pace when he became more of a suspect. It was on the TV all day long, breaking news.
Which included interviews of dozens of witnesses, a thorough examination and analysis of the physical evidence, sought and obtained a warrant for the arrest of O.J. Simpson, charging him with the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman.
The rumors started coming in where he was, kind of trying to track everybody's whereabouts. And then the day of the chase, the Bronco chase, is probably when I realized, oh my gosh, this is like beyond madness.
I think I just saw O.J. Simpson on the 5 freeway. He's heading north.
I remember that we knew he was going to turn himself in on the 17th, June 17th. And I remember thinking that this is ridiculous. Why is he allowed to turn himself in? Is that normal? You know, when you watch all your crime programs and everyone's handcuffed and they come and they knock on your door. So I was confused as to why he was allowed to turn himself in. And then I saw the press conference saying that he was a fugitive.
Mr. Simpson, in agreement with his attorney, was scheduled to surrender this morning to the Los Angeles Police Department. Initially, that was 11 o'clock. It then became 11:45. Mr. Simpson has not appeared.
Mr. Simpson is a fugitive of justice.
Soon after that, the helicopters found him on the freeway. It was CBS News, I remember.
This white Ford Bronco, and they moved in. They've had a conversation with O.J. Simpson, at which time he demanded that he be allowed to go to his mother's home, which is right not too far, we're told, from where he is right now. He is in the back seat with a gun pointed to his head. He is threatening suicide unless police go along with this. At this point, police have shown no inclination whatsoever to pull him over, to stop him. They're letting this drama play out as it happens.
I think that was probably the first time that I realized how big it was. Back in 94, the networks were basically your main few channels, and a very few cable networks that were starting at that time. But it is nothing like what it is today with the 24-hour news cycle. We were still heavily driven by newspapers, magazines. That was the time of National Enquirer and Star tabloids. It was not nearly the way that it is today. I don't even know if I can describe the stark differences between what it was then and now. We started to receive letters from all over the world. Mail was coming in from other countries supporting our family, definitely some hate mail coming through, and people following us in the stores, like talking about us, and just everywhere we were, people were whispering, and we were not aware really of how far-reaching, because we were in a bubble. I've talked a lot about how we were in a fishbowl, not understanding that other people were experiencing our life and not understanding why people were whispering and talking. We were sitting in a restaurant one night and it was the table directly behind, and they were talking about the case. And I just remember looking around going, wait, is that our case? It's a strange feeling to have people talking about you as if they know you, as if it's their experience. It sort of knocks you off your feet. It felt invasive and unsafe. It was on every channel. It was breaking news. Every day there was new rumors and new salacious details. And my dad and I were in the dark. We had no real information as to what was happening with the case. We weren't communicated with very much from the district attorney's office or the police department. We were learning facts right along with the rest of the world. The separation between the reality and what was happening on TV was kind of a blur until the trial started. I would say is when I probably started to notice the distinct differences between what was happening in the courtroom versus what was getting reported versus what we were being told, because I was sitting in court all day long and I would hear the testimony and I was in the room all day long from morning until night. And then I would get home and we would be talking about it at dinner because my dad often didn't get to go to court with us. And so he would watch the news and then he would come in and ask questions. And I'm like, well, that's not how it happened. And that's not really what the witness said. And where'd you get that piece of information? And then that's when I started to realize the distortion of how the news was presenting information. The feeling of being completely invaded everywhere you went, cameras everywhere, watching you everywhere. Every day there was new reports, new stories, new articles, new coverage, new person talking, new shows coming up on the radio all day long, whispers everywhere, people following us. And I'm just not exaggerating. In the early days of courts, I used to have to check the stalls to see who else was in the bathroom with me because reporters used to hide on the toilet and wait for me or my dad or whomever to come in. So I used to have to check all the stalls to make sure I was in there alone. I had special rooms I had to go to because people would listen in. I had one girl, I won't say her name, but she was from Geraldo Rivera's talk show. I remember being home and there was a knock on my front door and I very innocently opened the door randomly to a perfect stranger. And there was this girl standing on the porch and she was crying. And she was probably close to my age. And she said to me that her car had broken down and her tire broke or something. And I was like, oh my gosh, do you need to, she said, do you have a phone? And she's like, I need help. And so I was like, oh my goodness, come in. I'll get the phone for you in the kitchen. And then she was a producer from Geraldo's show. And she got into my house that way. I always felt like the media portrayed me as a weepy, crying, angry, fetal position, whiny baby all the time. And maybe I was, because my brother was just stabbed to death and I was pretty pissed and pretty sad. So it would be reasonable, but I also had a lot of insight as to what was happening. And my dad was always portrayed as the angry father who, you know, break down sometimes, but he was always angry. And the impression of us over the years has sort of evolved to that. We're angry that we can't get over it. You know, we have dark hearts because we are always mad at the killer. I mean, it sort of evolved, but because the media kept showing images of my dad, that was really hard because my dad is a big softy. And it was hard to see him portrayed the opposite of who he was to me. I have a love-hate relationship with the media as it relates to our case. Because cameras were allowed in the courtroom, as much as it was painful and hard to manage that, it ended up in some ways being helpful to us because the world got to see, if they chose, the trial itself.
One of the most dramatic moments of the trial to date, prosecutors had Simpson try on the gloves. Wearing latex gloves to protect the evidence, Simpson appeared to have trouble putting them on. Prosecutors suggest he was only pretending the gloves were too small.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder in violation.
If the cameras weren't in the courtroom for the criminal case and the killer, people find out that he was acquitted, people would think he's not guilty, right? And they would walk away thinking, oh, he's not guilty because the jury said he was not guilty. Having the cameras in the courtroom allowed people to decide for themselves whether or not the jury rendered an accurate verdict.
When it was time for the civil case, the judge decided not to have cameras in the courtroom.
He felt like it was a circus the first time, and he didn't want to have it be a distraction. So I was really nervous about that because I didn't know how the civil case was going to go. Luckily, the jury came back and said that unanimously that he had killed my brother.
Outside the courthouse, a crowd of several hundred had gathered as the announcement of the verdict neared.
Today's 2.5 years, a little over 2.5 years, and we finally have justice for Ron and Nicole.
Having all the media that we had, when both trials ended, I really started to mourn for the first time because it was the first time that I was left alone. I know it sounds crazy, but when you have people following you, people interested in you, people attached to your story, the media everywhere, it being as obsessive as it was when it all went away, I felt really alone and alone physically because all of a sudden I didn't have hordes of people. I didn't have protection everywhere. I didn't have escorts. And then I was left to deal with my grief. That was tricky for me because I didn't understand. We were a couple years into it and I didn't understand where all of this emotion was coming from. And it was really the first time, I think, as a family that we really started to embrace the loss in a way that we hadn't really done before. And that was both really hard and beautiful in the same vein, but the media never stopped calling. The media never stopped. And with new cases coming, it started to build momentum. Networks started to be born and radio shows started to be born and pundits. And that's when the cable news started to kind of pick up speed and they started covering trials and using our case as like the touchstone for all these other cases. And it just didn't end.
With me, Kim Goldman, the sister of Ron Goldman, offering her advice to Travis Alexander's family. Kim, thank you for being with us. What are your thoughts and your analysis?
My thoughts are, it's very frustrating, and I know that's what Travis's family is dealing with right now, wanting to scream and wanting to defend him because he's not here to defend himself, wanting to cheer on.
There were lots of opportunities for my dad and I to be more public with our opinions about the legal system and victims and survivors and domestic violence. And it was very overwhelming because there was a very strong sense of responsibility that was suddenly sort of bestowed upon us, and it was uncomfortable. I didn't know enough. I didn't feel like I experienced enough. I didn't feel confident enough to step into that role. And I didn't know what was expected. I was still knee deep in my grief at that point. I was just so in it that I couldn't figure out how to help other people. In hindsight, I realized that just talking about grief, talking about loss, talking about crime, the system, even if it was an unfiltered, unedited approach, was very helpful because we weren't having those conversations at that time. We weren't speaking out about domestic violence. Our case was really kind of the beginning, the tipping point of having more vocal conversations. In fact, it led to legislation. It led to laws being changed on a local level, but on a national level. It really just kind of flipped everything on its lid.
Reports of domestic violence went up 50% after that case came out. 50%.
Well, that's good. My dad and I gingerly sort of walked through that process because we didn't know what else to do. And there was such camaraderie with other victims and families that it felt safe. And at a time when we were feeling so exposed, having that community felt very comfortable. And then I started to find the balance between how much to put myself out there and how to protect myself and how to be okay with exposing myself in a way that was vulnerable for other people to share and benefit from. That took years. And I'm still kind of going through that because it's a lot to put yourself out there and know that you could potentially be subjected to more pain, more heartache, scrutiny. But the benefit is the incredible impact that I get to have from other people that I talk to and that they get to have from feeling connected. In the late 90s, the access to other people around the world was very limited. And so the connections that I was able to make with other people was just through showing up at events, being asked to train or lead a workshop or speak at a victims' rights event or whatever it was. So in those moments, I started to meet people, and it would be just getting off stage and having people come and ask questions and exchanging phone numbers and postal addresses so we could stay in touch. And then as the years progressed, that became websites, that became emails, that became social media feeds. And so as technology changed, my connection to people changed and my ability to help people on a grander scale grew because the access to connect was easier. So I now get emails from people all the time asking for help. What do I do? How do I do? Do you have an attorney? Do you have a victim advocate? Do you have a resource available? How did you manage this? Or people really wanting to share their story in a way that is just free, have somebody on the receiving end be in full acceptance of it.
If you're just now joining us, at least 14 dead, 50 injured. A lot of those injuries are severe after a lone gunman opens fire in a theater outside of Denver, Colorado, in Aurora.
I remember after the Aurora Theater shooting happened with the Dark Knight movie, when so many people were victimized in that mass shooting, one of the family members and I had worked on something together, and she had asked if I would get on a conference call with all of the families because their trial was starting soon and they wanted support. It was gearing up to be a pretty highly covered case, and they wanted to know how to protect themselves and how much to share and withhold from the media and what that balance and struggle is about. To be able to be sharing in their grief with them and to be trusted in a way that they could be vulnerable and express themselves. There's an immediate connection. There's an immediate understanding. There's an immediate rapport when I speak with other families that have endured some kind of trauma and some kind of tragedy. There's just like a lot of head nodding and there's a lot of crying and there's like a, yes, I feel the same thing. Oh my God, you finally get what I'm saying. There's just a camaraderie and a beautiful exchanging of emotion that I just feel really lucky to be able to have with other people.
So in 2015, I was fortunate to find a publisher who thought that my idea of talking about victims and survivors in a healthy, productive way was a stellar idea. So I was able to write an incredible book, which I think really helps victims and survivors, but also helps the public and also helps journalists understand the process of trauma and tragedy and how to commingle those two worlds in a way that's respectful and sensitive. Media Circus was an opportunity to go behind the scenes where the cameras turn off, highlight what was going on when everybody turned their backs, to show the growth, the resiliency, the courage, the bravery, the struggles, years of grief. I wanted to be able to tell other people's stories, and I wanted to be able to share the plight of other victims and survivors and the work that they were doing and bring their stories to the light in a way that is different. I love the opportunity to have done that with Media Circus, my book, and then with this podcast, because while I can share my experiences, I really want to focus on other people's stories and celebrate and highlight their triumphs. The mission of Media Circus is to meet our victims and survivors where they are and let the listener in on that experience in a way that isn't like other shows. It might be gritty.
When I turn 25, if this isn't solved, I'm done. I cannot do this forever.
There'll be humor. There'll be tears.
That event has informed the last 16, 17 years of my life, and it continues to do so.
It'll just be honest to let people into where they don't often get to go.
That's a heck of a question. That question I've never been asked.
Being in the public eye for as long as we have been, it's like being in a fishbowl. We just go round and around in there. There's all these people just looking at you, swimming around in there and kind of fumbling about. I want to bring people into the fishbowl. One could ask, am I contributing to the sensationalism or the exploitation of someone's trauma? And I'm going to say no. When you speak to victims and survivors, what they tell you most, number one, is they want the truth to be out there. They want to control the message. And so Media Circus will allow the victims and survivors to be in the driver's seat of their story. Do you think that the media accurately portrays what's actually going on?
Oh, hell no. No, they do not. They do not.
My goal is also to have an honest conversation about how the media impacts the process, how it impacts law enforcement and the legal system and the justice system. Where do they get it right? Where do they get it wrong? What was their involvement? How did it help or hurt a victim's family? There are lots of times where the media will do these big, huge stories and they just sort of discard the victim and their family. And then when they need them again, they come pounding on their door. I want to talk about the responsibility that media has when they tell stories. And journalists listen to this show and learn how to be a little bit more respectful and honest in their coverage of crime victims. I hope that you walk away feeling a deeper connection, a deeper understanding, a deeper sensitivity, a deeper awareness to a story that you thought you knew inside and out. Because the truth is, you know what the media wants you to know. I want you to know what our victims and survivors want you to know. Writing Media Circus and then doing the podcast Media Circus is to really give the control back to the people whose story we're watching or listening to, because so often it is happening outside of us. Regardless of whether or not we consent to participating in an interview, they're going on without us. Movies are being made, podcasts are happening, books are being written, stories are being shared, and oftentimes it's without our consent. And then that becomes the constant conversation of, do I engage? Do I correct? Do I ignore? And that happens with other victims and survivors constantly. There are tons of things that are happening without our knowledge, and people are portraying images and perceptions of us without ever having spoken to us. On the podcast, I hope to really dispel any myths, dispel any rumors, to correct the record, and again, to give complete consent and permission to the people whose stories we're talking about, that they're the ones that control the message, because getting your voice back is such an incredible and powerful thing that I think we don't realize when it's gone, that how important it is for us to get it back. Media Circus is a Cast original podcast, executive produced and hosted by me, Kim Goldman, produced by Jackie McDougall. Harper Carlton is our associate producer. Subscribe to my new show, Media Circus, from Cast Media, wherever you listen to podcasts. And please leave us a rating and review.